Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I am your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Gabriel Krauser. Gabriel, how are you, sir?
Well, thank you, Nicholas. I just got a great book published by the IRR many years ago, so delighted.
Yes, would you like to give us a title for our audience?
The Liberal Slideaway by Jill Wenzel.
Very useful and instructive of perhaps some of what is going on with all the attacks on the IRR in the media right now. Also, we have, of course, Mr. Becky Mahlobo. Becky, how are you, sir?
How's it, Nick? I'm doing well. It's been a while. How's it, Gabriel?
Yeah. Good to have you on the show. And it is the first time that Gabriel and Becky are on the show together, which is quite fun.
Yeah.
So I just want to, you know, this is, I have to do the
and,
YouTube.
And we're not even going to talk about Bitcoin. This is terrible.
But anyway. No, I know. Which is, of course, Becky's favorite topic. I must do the usual YouTube stuff and say, please don't forget to like, comment, subscribe on this video if you like it. If you're listening to us on the podcast version, please leave us a nice review. We'd really appreciate that. That helps us to spread the tendrils of our influence across the world and make us an unignorable force in the battle of ideas. Anyway, let us dive right into it. And that is, let's start with a complaint made by the chief whip of the Democratic Alliance, Natasha Mazzoni, who said on, I think it was on Twitter, that there was unfair treatment of political parties when it came to COVID lockdown regulations. Natasha said that there were double standards and that the EFF and the ANC during their manifesto launches very obviously and blatantly broke the 500-person capacity limit that has been implemented by the government when it came to the crowd sizes at their manifesto launches. And yet they appear to have suffered no repercussions for this. The DA, to avoid this problem, actually held an entirely virtual manifesto launch. I think they did it all on YouTube or something like that. But anyway, she went on to say, numerous images and videos circulated across social media of the EFF and ANC's campaigning events, which displayed a disregard for lockdown regulations such as the 500-person outdoor limit, mask wearing, and social distancing. The ANC has clearly exempted itself and the EFF from lockdown regulations, but is imposing it on everyone else to the detriment of the economy and individual rights and freedoms. This double standard cannot continue. And it's not just complaining by the opposition. We have a very concrete example of precisely the sort of double standard. So obviously no one was arrested for the EFF or the ANC marches and events. And yet there was a march held in Durban yesterday by the Shembe, by a group within the Shembe church. They were marching in connection to a factional dispute within the church. They say that the organizers say that they plan to have 500 people attend in accordance with the lockdown regulations, but about 5,000 people showed up. So I'm not sure if they really did have 500 people in it planned, but anyway, a lot of people did show up. The organizers say that they made every effort they could to try and comply with regulations. People were wearing masks. They say they tried to break the march up into groups of 500 so that there weren't too many people together at any one time. They said that they sort of all had to do this on the fly because more people showed up than they anticipated. And yet, one of the organizers of the march was arrested by the police for breaching the lockdown regulations. And he was charged with contravention of the Disaster Management Act for, quote, failing to comply with rules and agreements. Gabriel, looks sort of quite obvious that there is one set of rules for thee and a different set of rules for me. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, if you're in the ANC ruling alliance, the ANC, SACP, EFF, Youth League Alliance, I do think that it must have been a tricky business for opposition parties to call the ANC and the EFF out on this. I try to look up, because obviously on the one hand you're saying, you guys are a bunch of hypocrites. You've got all these rules and then you're breaking your own rules. But on the other hand, it's like, wow, you're wildly popular. Look how many people are showing up to your rallies. I checked out videos of the rallies. I do think that the Shembe Church had a few more people. I don't think the numbers were that high at the EFF and the ANC rallies, although they did clearly exceed the 500 legal limit, which is the point here. It is worth remembering that the limit had been 100 during earlier phases of lockdown, and that part of the election court case battle was the ANC and the EFF both saying that it would be impossible for them to campaign unless they could have mass gatherings. So it has been their point of view, effectively, that they would break these rules if the rules weren't changed to give them what they wanted. I don't see a real democratic argument for that. You can have smaller rallies. You can have, I mean, the main thing that they were arguing for is sort of door to door. And this is a point that's been repeated in the media. How can you expect politicians to have a campaign in the time of COVID if they can't go door to door? Well, of course, journalists are going door to door all the time. It's the easiest thing you can do as a politician right now is go and listen to what your constituents have to say. From a COVID management point of view, of course, it's not very easy. From the water's not working, it's poisoned. Electricity is often not on because you can't generate power. And then even when it is on, we're being unfairly load reduced because of the other people who are not paying. And even when that's not happening, there's fuses from the substation or the mini substation are being stolen and they're not being replaced on time. And even when they are replaced, and they just get stolen again because the box isn't properly locked. That kind of thing is difficult to deal with as a politician when it's being spat in your face by angry residents who haven't had their services delivered. But from a COVID management point of view, it couldn't be easier to go and hear what your constituents have to say. Broader point, the virus is doing what always seemed most likely, which is to be in the trough. This is kind of the best time in the history of the plague to be out and about. Especially if you've been vaccinated, also especially if you have been infected and have recovered. And Discovery's last estimate was that something like 70% of South Africa had been infected and recovered. So our lockdown regulations are deeply out of connection with the best available science and evidence, have been consistently. The hypocrisy exposed by this case where people get arrested from a church where everyone's in white and acting quite in a relatively disciplined fashion, whereas at the political party rallies where they're going quite wild, no one gets arrested. That hypocrisy exposes a much deeper problem, which is the problem that businesses have faced in this time and which they continue to face on the back of a deeply unempirical kind of put your finger in the air, what do you feel like attitude to how lockdown should work. And the longer the National Disaster Management Act stays in force, the longer South Africans are going to have to look in the rearview mirror and say, how did we let that happen? How did we let a command council, an actual command council, so-called, dictate our daily lives in this hypocritical fashion for over a year and a half? It's crazy.
So I think I want to go to the principle here, which is that when you extend the power of government to all sorts of spheres, you can begin to see this kind of discretionary discrimination in the application of the law, which is often some of the most dangerous forms of oppression. So, you know, we've got a good example here, I think, Becky, where we're seeing the political parties seem to be being treated differently, and organizations across, you know, civil society is being treated differently to certain political parties. But we also see it in the attempt to regulate party funding, which is that while the DA and the EF, the DA and the ANC declared their funders for the last quarter, the EFF said, rather, I think not that credibly, no, we didn't have any big donors. We don't need donations. The EFF is a completely self-sufficient organization. So once again, and they don't seem to have gotten in much trouble for this, as have most of the small parties who didn't talk about their donors either. Baker, do you agree with that sort of principle? I mean, is this a real concern when we have things like lockdowns and regulation of speech?
It is a true concern. I think before I go answer there, I think it was also the EFF Plus that didn't declare. If I'm incorrect,
yes, Although they are a bit smaller, so I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't have a donor or something. But still, a bit suspicious.
The most concerning thing about COVID regulations, really, they have a great impact in terms of economic output when you're looking at small businesses and whatnot. Like, the first thing that really comes to mind when we still had the very hard lockdowns was the regulations on restaurants, for example. How many people should you have in a restaurant and so forth. And the really sad part is that as these government officials break these rules, ordinary South Africans suffer the consequences. And that's the real problem that, unfortunately, we're currently facing. I think this is also true when you look at other countries as well, like the US. I'm just going to deviate for a little bit. When you look at the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, who regulated restaurant number of people in a restaurant. Then the next day he went to a fancy restaurant while small restaurants were not allowed to open, essentially. And I think the result of this is that people will become frustrated. People will then retaliate and not really follow the rules. And I think I've really seen that to a large extent as well. For example, where people are just not following the COVID regulations. Some of them are nonsensical, as Gabriel has mentioned. By now, where you have a lot of people basically vaccinated, either receiving their first jab or their second jab, or already have been reinfected.
Go ahead, Gabe.
If I could just jump in there in terms of the discipline question. Yeah, I mean, there's something I've noticed. Some people sort of walk into the restaurant like this.
Yeah.
And then they sit down. because it's a culture now. It's a ritual. It has nothing to do with science. And everything to do with the culture. But there is something about South Africa's, I can imagine an authoritarian saying the following. 2019 SAPS data shows that we have 10 violent protests per day on average through the year, over 3,500 through the year. Now, if you live in a big city, then you probably can remember images of like violent political clashes in the CBD going through Gandhi Square. Maybe you have some memories of Luthuli House bullets being sprayed way back 25 years ago. Something about the Zuma Must Fall protests a few years ago. But you might not have a strong sense of what this is like. If you live in small town South Africa or rural South Africa, then you'll know all too well what it looks like for your town to be besieged, for the businesses' glass fronts to be knocked through, for looting to take place on a sort of not just a mid-July basis, but on the now and then, and also for trucks to be pulled over, their goods to be taken out, the trucks to be burnt down. This happens regularly on the major arteries of South Africa. That's why we get the figure of 10 per day. Okay, here comes a virus, and you think, well, maybe he has an excuse to lock it all down and make sure that that doesn't happen. It's not really scientific. It's a little bit of a culture thing, but it is having a positive effect. No, that's not even what's happening here, right? The most important and most politically dangerous protests have been the Zuma Must Fall protests, where thousands, tens of thousands of people gathered up. Those were largely, those truly were peaceful protests happening in particularly Joburg, Pretoria, and Cape Town, but also around the country. Those were not looting exercises. Those were, you know, ordinary working class South Africans getting up with posters to say, this guy's still running the country, get rid of him. And that did apply pressure, which I think made it ultimately impossible for Nkosi Sibanye Dlamini Zuma to win at NASREC in 2017. So those kinds of mass gathering events, that's what's banned. What's not effectively banned is the 100 or 200 people it takes to besiege a little town, burn businesses, throw rocks, hijack trucks, pull them over and burn them down. And that is still happening. We don't have good data on exactly the extent to which it's happening. But on the basis of the reports that we've been seeing and on the basis of the July 2021 riots, we have a clear indication that whatever the government's doing, it's not really stopping the virus and it's not really stopping public incidents of violence.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. It's exposing kind of how farcical a lot of the stuff is. You know, you both have mentioned silly regulations, and Gabriel, you're much more up to date on the science than I. But is there any sort of reasonable justification for the curfew as a sort of standard thing? I can understand maybe putting a curfew on New Year's or something like that. But.
Dude, everybody knows if you must read The Lancet. It's a scientific journal. And its sub-headline is, coronavirus doesn't hang out after midnight. Ah. Sorry, only comes out after midnight. That's what it's like. I get it's like a vampire in my head brain.
It sticks in you, yeah.
No, I mean, the argument was you need to reduce the workload on hospitals by stopping people from going out and getting drunk. And that's the reason for curfew. Our hospital load has been relatively well in a relatively good position for the last month plus. And in addition, I mean, the reason the hospital load was poor is in part in Johannesburg because of a major burn down in Joburg, right. Gen, effectively.
Which has not been repaired yet.
Which has still not been repaired. What's the thought? Like when the government fails to deliver services, when the government screws up, burns down a building, doesn't manage it properly, then it must just take away people's civil liberties. This is not a reasonable way of.
No, definitely. Becky, I like the point you brought up in the US that this hypocrisy is certainly not contained to South Africa. It's perhaps worse here, but we've seen a lot of political leaders across the world flouting their own regulations. And I think this is really undermining trust.
At some point, hip hop were illegal, Nick.
I should have bought some air during that period, but I was late. Anyway, right, so I think we've put that one to bed. Let us continue on with our next topic, which is relating to a victory for what we think is common sense in the courts. Earlier this year, the Minister of Tourism attempted to make it so that you had to comply with BEE regulations in order to receive COVID funds. If you were in the tourism sector, which is, shall we say, quite, I think it's difficult to view it as anything other than mean-spirited, because, of course, an awful number of tourist businesses lost literally all of their business during the COVID lockdowns. They were effectively outlawed. And suddenly the government was saying, no, you also have to make sure that you comply with BEE regulations. So if you were, you know, a middle-aged white lady in the Western Cape who runs a B&B, you were out of luck. Anyway, this went to court. I think AfriForum took it to court and the Solidarity Trade Union, and the Supreme Court of Appeal said that you couldn't have emergency relief funds tied to BEE. Well, in a speech, the Deputy Minister of Tourism, Fish Malalehlele, at a celebration of World Tourism Day, said that this was very unfortunate the court had decided this. He said, quote, "It is a pity that some people have tended to understand transformation in a negative sense of it undermining free market principles and slowing down the momentum of hard-won gains in the tourism sector or the broader economy. To the contrary, we as the ANC government see transformation as a necessary tool for nation building and social cohesion, which helps us to redress the imbalances of the past. It also helps us to ensure that people who were historically excluded from this sector of the economy will find a fair share of participation. We are able to drive inclusivity by ensuring that everyone participates in tourism and that those who lack sufficient means are supported by the state. Inclusivity does not, however, end there. It also entails we broaden the scope of tourism subsectors to expand tourism beyond its conventional reach to include other subsectors such as the rural and township tourism, cultural and sports tourism, just to mention a few." He basically goes on to say that, imply that BEE regulations for COVID relief grants would make tourism, not just in terms of providers, but also in terms of customers, more accessible to the poor in South Africa. Becky, what is he on about?
Sorry, there's like the car driving by playing music. My bad. My apologies, everyone. Correct me if I'm wrong, Nick or Gabriel, but the sense that I'm getting from most policymakers within the ANC is that they've given up on actually growing the South African economy. I see this through the public statements as well as the policies that they write. Ah, come on now. Sorry about that.
No, it just keeps the podcast vibey, you know?
Keeps it vibey. For example, such as that of BEE, right? Rather than actually growing the South African economy, you then take on a redistributive policy such as BEE, and we can see that it does not help a great majority of South Africans. Every time I hear a government official speaking about BEE and speaking about transformation, which we've had it over the last 10 years and so forth, I've never seen them refer to any point in time in which it has benefited a great majority of South Africans. It's only a select few, well, those politically connected, of course. Now, the issue with this is that you're doing this on top of the tourism sector, which has been completely decimated. And the only thing that currently holds South Africa currently is the mining sector because of our, because of the commodity boom that we're currently witnessing, as well as the reopening up of other countries and so forth. So it's absolutely bad, Nick. Yeah, it's truly sad, honestly.
Gabriel, what do you make of the Deputy Minister's sort of slightly, I think, non sequitur claims here?
Yeah, okay, so let's try and break it down into three claims. The one claim is that that BEE is good for business because it's good for political stability. This is the argument that BEE is so popular that if you were to take it away, whatever the other economic effects would be, there would be looting and riots and everyone would be very unhappy and that would ultimately be bad for business. So you've got to give BEE because the poor black masses are so hungry for it. It's the same kind of argument for why you have to have expropriation without compensation, that ultimately, as expensive as it might be, it's cheaper than burning the country down. Now, okay, you sit in Sandton, you have a cocktail, you have nice Gucci shoes, and you drive away in your Wabenzi, and your opinion is that the poor black masses are so hungry for BEE that they're going to burn the country down if they don't get it. We have a scientific approach. We go and ask people, thousands, random demographically representative surveys, and we do this year in, year out. We've been doing it for at least 8 years, let's say. And we find consistently that most South Africans are very pragmatic, very down to earth, and they want what matters, and they're not into this sort of color-coded reconfiguration schema. People want to form a working economy. They want to form a household. They want to form a family. They don't want to transform a brochure from one color to another. That's not what puts meat and potatoes on the table. So the political argument for stability is a nonsense. It's just people speaking on behalf of other people who look like them, and as if that gives them moral authority. The second argument is that it's good for business because, you know, these previously disadvantaged people who've been excluded from the market, and the market has effectively got a taste-based yearning for whiteness, which is driving inefficiencies into the labor force. Now, again, it's just not the case. You can look back empirically through the 90s when the economy opened up. People were very eager for the most part to work together on a meritocratic basis. People remain very eager to work together on a meritocratic basis. This is one of the joys, actually, of living in South Africa, is how unstupid it is compared to sort of what, you know, academics and American intellectuals would make things out to be. People are pretty keen on getting the basics right when it comes to their private lives. Unfortunately, when it comes to politics, we've had a few bottlenecks. But in terms of what's holding the market back, it's not some kind of widespread taste-based racism. We see all of the evidence going against that. What is holding the market back in general are extremely onerous labor regulations, business regulations, a general environment so rife with corruption that investing money is a little bit like pouring water into the desert sand. You know, if you're very lucky, there's a cup underneath there and you might grow. But for the most part, it's just gone before into someone's back pocket into Dubai, before you get a second whiff. So that's a huge part of the problem. Of course, with tourism, there's been an added problem. Which is the fact that global tourism markets have shut down and South Africa's economy is shrinking as much as it did last year, ushering 1.5 million jobs. It's very difficult for people to go get a bit of extra cash to go on a bit of a holiday. For those who can, I've been lucky enough to do that in the spring. It's been a joy. It's very nice to get around and see a bit of South Africa. And I think if you can afford to support a bit of local tourism, do so. But it has been very heavy days. So this leads us to, you know, the needs-based argument for basically insurance, insuring a sector that has been struck by a force majeure, sort of an act of God, as it were, or maybe an act of the Wuhan Institute of Virology. In any event, an act so devastating that no small business can reasonably be expected to have insured against it. And that's really what the government's handout's supposed to be. A form of social insurance. Who is employed in South Africa's tourism sector, if you want to break things down by race? Overwhelmingly black people. That is because we sit in a country whose number one mess up of all of the things I haven't already mentioned. The number one mess up is the failure of our government to secure a public school system that would skill people up to the requisite level to jump right into white collar jobs where you're doing accounting and engineering. And yes, we have a lot of people who do that, but we should have so many more. We are in a country with a lot of semi-skilled and underskilled people. And tourism is a great industry for absorbing that, because what does it take to be good in the tourism industry? It takes personability. It takes responsibility. It takes a sense of care for the customer. And that is something that you don't need to go to school to get a good sense of. And that is something that South Africa has in bucket loads. And that's where that good, positive human energy has been directed and channeled. And it's been, you know, it's been a great brand success for the country that so many people come here and have such wonderful experiences. Go ask more people to bring foreign currency in here, which is good for our economy and very good for those people being directly affected. So, yes, you know, you can gouge the eyeballs out of the tourism sector in spite, and the people that are ultimately being hardest hit, as always, are poor black South Africans on whose behalf the ANC claims to drive transformation. It's just a ridiculous repeat of the same old story where politicians claim to speak on behalf of exactly the people whose faces they are stomping into the ground.
That was a magnificent rant, sir. Well done. All right, we are running out of time, so let me very quickly rush on to our last topic, and that is our president, while all of this trouble goes on, is calling for the suspension of intellectual property rights on with regards to the COVID vaccines.
So, man.
Speaking at the opening of the World Trade Organization, he said that, you know, we really need to ensure that the third world, that poor people, the developing world can get access to vaccines for COVID-19. And the only way to do this was to get rid of any intellectual property rights with regards to the vaccine so that anyone could make the vaccines for themselves. And then he sort of said, well, South Africa is leading the way because we're already making vaccines. Gabriel, very briefly, is this as stupid as it sounds?
Yes, this is as stupid as it sounds. You can get a free, if Ramaphosa wants, you can call me. I'll show him. There's Icelandic scientists that have a free vaccine recipe that's available. All of the vaccine recipes that have been developed took a day to develop. It's very easy, it turns out, with modern genomic computer equipment, effectively, to figure out what kind of recipe you want for a vaccine. That's the IP bit. The very difficult bit is manufacturing, making sure that it keeps clean, making sure that it keeps reliable, then testing it. If you were to develop a new one, you'd have to go through all of that. If you don't go through all of that, you're not stealing IP. You're stealing testing capacity. But most, if that sounds too complicated, consider this. The South African government was offered 15 million free Sputnik V vaccines in March this year that would have been rolled out by the end of May. We had 15 million free on the table. We said no. Our issue is not that we haven't got enough vaccines. That was our issue. I mean, insofar as it's our issue, it's not because of vaccine nationalism. It's because of command council power clutching. And then our second issue is that a lot of people don't want the vaccine, or they don't want this vaccine, they want that vaccine. And if you can't trust, I mean, look at the trust levels in South Africa's government. 90% of South Africans think the country's going in the wrong direction. You can't find, you like 8 in 10 South Africans think the police are all criminals, which is an exaggeration of the facts, but it's not an exaggeration of the data. Who wants an ANC-produced vaccine? I mean, you're going to, if you want to create anti-vaxxers out of thin air, give Dlamini Zuma, put her face on the vaccine. The only reason anyone still wants to get this vaccine is because they know it wasn't made by the ANC. And Cyril Ramaphosa wants to take even that away.
I see, Becky, you're struggling to contain your mirth at that idea. Very briefly, it kind of seems to me like the ANC is sort of going back to the well of ideology on this one.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. Sorry about that, Nick. The sage has spoken. The problem that Gabriel has mentioned is very much true. The problem is not necessarily that we don't have enough vaccines. The whole internationalization of vaccines and the start of the process at that time earlier on this year. If you recall, earlier on, the government said that they will be the ones that purchase the vaccines and distribute them, whereas we had more than enough capacity from medical aid companies to buy vaccines and then distribute it to their members. I think at some point, medical aids companies were even offering to vaccinate people that were not covered by their medical aid and stuff. And then Zweli Mkhize said no. So the problem that we have is not necessarily the fact that intellectual property is preventing South Africa from manufacturing vaccines. The problem is an ideology issue within that of the ANC.
Well said, sir. All right, that's all the time we have for today. So thank you very much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show. Please support the Institute of Race Relations. Go to irr.org.za, click the Join Us button. Please like, comment, subscribe, leave us good reviews, all that good stuff. And we shall see you tomorrow on the Daily French Show. We hope you have a wonderful, most marvelous, and excellent day. Cheers, everyone.